Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, the first black bachelorette choosing among suitors of every color, a struggling Pakistani-American comedian choosing a white partner over an arranged marriage, 50 years after Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, Hollywood, on the big screen and small, is getting into the real details of romance between people of different races. Real life, real love, real messy sometimes. This hour on Point, Hollywood's depiction of interracial romance now. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you seen the new movie, The Big Sick, the latest Bachelorette? Do you relate? Is Hollywood up to speed with our culture and its relationship realities? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Bachelorette, people talking about that, The Big Sick. Movie's getting a lot of attention as well. Zoe Kazan plays Kamel's love interest, Emily, who's white. Here in the film's trailer, some of the complications they have as a couple. Here, she finds a cigar box full of headshots of South Asian women.
Are you judging Pakistan's next hot model?
You know how we have arranged marriage in my culture?
Oh my God, I'm so stupid. Can you imagine a world in which we end up together?
I don't know.
I don't know. He doesn't know. They sort of do. He meets her father, played by Ray Romano, Terry, in The Big Sick, and the movie follows his immediate struggle to relate to Kamel.
So, 9/11. No, I mean, I've always wanted to have a conversation about it with people.
You've never talked to people about 9/11?
Oh, my gosh, from The Big Sick, Ray Romano. He meets the boyfriend, Muslim, Pakistani background. First question, so 9/11. And we're in the thick of it. Joining me first today from New York is Sopan Dev, a culture reporter for The New York Times. He wrote a piece on Tuesday headlined, The Big Sick, South Asian Identity and Me. Sopan, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Would you be generous enough to tell us the story of this movie just a little bit?
Yeah, so basically, Kamel Nanjiani, it's a real-life story about how Kamel Nanjiani, who is a who was born in Karachi, came over to the United States with his family, grew up here in the U.S. Basically, the story is about the struggles of a South Asian man growing up with the pressures of arranged marriage on him. But he meets Emily Gordon, who is a grad student in the movie, falls in love. But in essence, he's stuck between two worlds. That he falls in love with Emily Gordon in spite of the fact that his parents want to arrange him to get married to a Muslim woman. And then eventually she falls into a coma. At that point, Kamel realizes that he is... he's in love with Emily and kind of eschews his family and says, well, this is who I want to be with. And that's the central conflict in the movie. The movie was co-written by Kumail and his real-life wife, Emily Gordon. Zoe Kazan is the starring opposite Kumail. Mm-hmm. Ray Romano and Holly Hunter in it as well. But, that's basically the rundown of the story.
Here's a little bit. This is back in 2011 on The Green Room with Paula Provenza. Kamel Nanjiani, talking about being an immigrant comedian, said that sometimes stereotypes can come from good, well-intentioned places. But this is about his real story that informs The Big Sick.
I got married to a white girl from North Carolina, and for the first year, her family called me Borat. That's what they called me.
Was that a term of affection, at least?
I honestly do think it was. It was
the movie hadn't even come out yet.
They were way ahead of the curve. They were like, this movie's going to be big. It's like not even the right landmass, you know?
Okay, that's kind of incredible. I mean, this is the real deal. He did indeed marry a white girl from North Carolina. For the first year he asserts there, the family called him Borat. So, Pandeb, I mean, you can relate to this, South Asian family, Pakistani background in the U.S.,
sure.
But, you know, you wrote in your essay that you relate very well to this. For a long time, you could not even talk with your family about your romantic interest with girls or then women who were outside the sort of the bubble.
Yeah, that's right. When I watched The Big Sick, I came away with a very visceral reaction, which was this was, on some level, this was my story. And it was being reflected in film and TV, which is something that's relatively rare. It's less rare for South Asian males than it is for South Asian women, because they're very much, you know, there are not that many roles out there right now, unfortunately, for South Asian women. But it was the first time, one of the first times I had seen a romantic comedy in which a South Asian male was the lead. But it very much reflected, I felt, my upbringing in that, you know, when I was growing up, you know, I grew up in a mostly white town, and, you know, when I went to high school and college, you know, I dated women that were not South Asian, and it was something my parents growing up were always, you know, they were uncomfortable with. My brother, who is 10 years older than me, he had a Catholic ceremony. He got married to a white Catholic, and it was something my mom, you know, she never fully came to terms with those nuptials. And I remember her saying to me when I was 19, I believe, when my brother got married, and, you know, she said to me, look, she called me Shambo, which is my Indian nickname. She would say, listen, I want you to marry an Indian girl. I want you to have an Indian wedding. And I think a lot of that stems from wanting to keep your culture, and also just not having to explain that much stuff to a, you know, to an in-law. But also on top of that, let me also add that this is a small slice of South Asian culture. Not everyone has this experience.
Sure.
It's not a monolithic, you know, Kumail's experience and my experience were by no means, you know, wholly representative of a totally non-monolithic culture. And after I wrote the essay, I got a lot of emails that said, you're absolutely right, that was my story. And I also got a lot of emails that said, you're wrong, that was not my upbringing. So it definitely is a mixed bag in that respect.
I mean, you remind us, there's been films and TV and more going way back. I mean, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, 1967, the same year as the Supreme Court's Loving decision. Of course, Loving, the movie, is out now. Say The Last Dance, 2001. I mean, and you've got Monsters Ball or Zoe Saldana in the remake of Guess Who. There's always questions about erasure, who gets depicted here and who doesn't. You remind us that on the website Jezebel, the Brooklyn artist Aditi Natasha Kini wrote a critique of The Big Sick. The headline was, I'm tired of watching brown men fall in love with white women on screen. What do you say to that?
Well, we've actually talked at length about this. Aditi and I, we were actually on WNYC yesterday talking about this. I don't think she's totally wrong. Because the fact of the matter is, Aditi's story does not get told all that often. However, my response to that particular critique is that this was Kumail's story. This was one small slice of South Asian culture that is being told. And I think it amounts to a sort of erasure to fault him for that, because this is not just Kumail's story. This is also Emily Gordon's story, who co-wrote the movie with Kumail. Emily is Kumail's real-life wife, who helped write the movie. Wrote the movie with Kumail, excuse me. And I feel like the criticism of the movie, there is some very valid criticism, but I feel like The Big Sick is the wrong vehicle for that criticism. And secondly, I think that The Big Sick is a step forward, because it's still very rare to see people like Kumail get those kind of roles in Hollywood. For the most part, in Hollywood, it's still very much, you know, a lot of Asian American roles get whitewashed, or they don't get cast at all, or the only roles that people like Kumail and Asif Manvi, and only the roles that they can kind of get are like the cab drivers or the terrorists.
Yeah,
you know, and it was, to me, it was
here he's the lead. He's the romantic lead,
right? And that just doesn't happen very often. And I cited a couple examples in.
Hello, Sopan, are you there, my friend? Here's a moment from The Big Sick, where talking about who gets erased and how people get depicted, where in the film, Kumail's mother, played by Zenobia Shroff, tries to set him up with a potential wife. Arranged marriage is a big theme here. Limited success in this interaction.
I wonder who that could be.
I'm guessing it's a young, single Pakistani woman.
This is Zubeda.
For your files?
Your ex-files?
That's your favorite show, huh?
The truth is out there.
So Pandeb, all in all, what do you see happening here? Do you see between Master of None, I don't know, maybe even The Bachelorette, first black bachelorette out there right now, The Big Sick, with this depiction of a South Asian and Caucasian, white American romance. Do you see some new level of granular reality coming here? Do you see Hollywood getting a better fix on where the full culture really is?
Glass half full, glass half empty, right?
Yeah.
Glass half full is that Kumail being cast in this movie was a big step forward. The movie has been successful, and now Cassie agents can say, "Okay, look, we can cast someone of South Asian or Arab or Muslim identity, and we can draw in box office numbers." Okay, that's the glass half full. Glass half empty. There was a report in the Hollywood Reporter, I think about a month ago, that said they were having trouble finding someone to play Aladdin.
What do you mean? How can that be? To play Aladdin? We've got a lot of Americans who could play Aladdin.
There was a story in the Hollywood Reporter that Guy Ritchie had done a bunch of auditions, and they were finding someone that they felt could play Aladdin well.
I don't even get that. Our country's chock-a-block with people who could be cast as Aladdin, I would think.
Well, tell Hollywood that, because they were thinking about casting Dev Patel or Riz Ahmed, and something happened where they decided to go another route, and they had lots of casting auditions in other parts of the world. And then if you read the story, some sources told Hollywood Reporter they couldn't find a good fit. I think there are not enough people like Kumail Nanjiani and Asif Manvi and the list goes on and on. But we'd also, it's not as bad as it was in the 1960s. And also, it's progress. It's certainly progress. So I look at it as a glass half full with this movie, but I also understand the criticism of it. I get that. But I don't think Kumail's story was going to be everything for everyone.
And what about your story? Is your mom now okay if you go outside the culture, outside the Pakistani-American community, or she's still got her hands on her hips about that?
I will say that it's. I'll just leave it at this. It's an evolving conversation.
Yeah, that sounds like family life right there. Sopan Deb, you're really good to join us for a moment today. Culture reporter at the New York Times. The Big Sick, South Asian Identity and Me was his piece over the weekend. Sopan, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, it's Tom. Before we get back to the show, I wanted to tell you to be sure and stay with us till the very end of this podcast for a preview of Freak Out and Carry On. It's WBUR's new podcast that addresses today's politics through a historical lens. Give it a listen, and thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Hollywood's depiction of interracial relationships these days, romances, and how it's changing from The Bachelorette to The Big Sick. You can join us this hour. Have you watched Black Bachelorette Rachel Lindsay, the first Black Bachelorette? Lovely. Narrowing her choices down to a white guy, a black guy, and a Latino. Have you watched Aziz Ansari in Master of None, navigating love, culture, color? Have you seen The Big Sick? Lovers, white and brown, their families, expectations, their own. How is this as a depiction? How's Hollywood doing on the big screen, on TV these days, in conveying the nuance, the complexity, the reality of interracial romance in America? Just a little more here from The Big Sick trailer, directed by Michael Showalter. Viewers given a glimpse into the film's discussion of interracial relationships. Here's Kumail, the lead character played by Kumail Nanjiani, talking to his brother, Naveed, played by Adil Akhtar.
I have to tell you something, babe. I've been dating this girl. She's white.
A white girl?
Okay, you can't look like you and yell white girl.
It's okay. We hate terrorists.
Okay. You can say white girl as long as you say that after. Or The Bachelorette. It is the show's 13th season. ABC's The Bachelorette finally welcoming here a black woman for the first time as a bachelorette. Rachel Lindsay stars in this season. The show's nearing its conclusion in a few weeks when she'll choose one of three remaining male contestants who are black, white, and Colombian to be her fiancé. Her season of The Bachelorette has encouraged discussion of race among contestants, and here are two of the men, Will and Eric, both black, discussing their past dating experiences on The Bachelorette.
I'll be straight up with it. Like, I typically date white girls.
You know, sometimes, you know, people have stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And, like, you can't really put her in a stereotype.
Yeah. You know, it's not that I don't date black girls. I have. But, you know, growing up where I grew up, there were, you know, especially in high school, like, there weren't a lot of black girls in my high school.
Right, right.
And then when I went to college, there was even fewer.
Sixth episode this year. I mean, they're talking about it there. And here, Rachel Lindsay was able to respond to Will's statement about his past dating patterns. Will, who is black, had said, "I typically only dated white girls." Here's Rachel.
I grew up the same way, and I wouldn't say that I dated predominantly non-black people.
Yeah.
You know, like, I actually have predominantly dated black people.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, clearly I'm open to everyone at this point, but, and I always have been, but, you know, me being, like, I told you, I pretty much grew up the same way you did. And I don't know. I didn't have that. No.
There it is, on TV, talking about it. We're talking about it. Clover Hope joins us now from New York. She's a senior writer at the website Jezebel, covering pop culture. Clover Hope, welcome to On Point. It's wonderful to have you with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Great to have you here. Great to have you. From Washington, Lena Jaiswal joins us, professor of film and media arts at the School of Communication at American University. Lena, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Nice to be here.
And also from Washington, Katie Borum Chatu. She is executive in residence at the School of Communication, director of the Center for Media and Social Impact at American University. Was a longtime collaborator with TV producer Norman Lear, who created The Jeffersons. Lena, who is a woman of a family Indian background, married to a white guy, and Katie, a white woman married to a black guy. They are working on a documentary called Mixed, in which they travel across the country talking to people about mixed race relationships. So they are really in the thick of this. I want to put it to all three of you. And Clover, may I start with you? What about these recent depictions, whether it's The Bachelorette or The Big Sick or Master of None or Mindy Kaling or you name it? Do you see evolution in the way in our pop culture arena of big and small screen, interracial relationships are being treated, Clover?
Yeah, I think there's definitely just kind of this surge of projects, film and TV, that are showing different variety of relationships. So variations of love in a way that wasn't really depicted before, or maybe 5 years ago even, there weren't this many projects that actually kind of endeavored to show these that there's more than one type of relationship. You know, there's more than just like two white people on screen. The rom-coms that are kind of typically, you know, in a big city and showing like two white people falling in love, there are variations of that. So with The Big Sick, we have kind of this story about Pakistani and a white woman. And we have The Bachelorette with the first black bachelorette. And it was actually my first time watching the series because of that. You know, I can kind of relate to that search for love. And the fact that it was 13 seasons before that happened is mind-boggling.
That's a lot of seasons in this country.
Yeah. I definitely think there's some growth, there's some progress, and I think within that progress, it's great to see the criticism working in tandem with it, because I think you need those two in order to create more progress. Like, well, look, you need the criticism as well.
We'll look at the criticism and the progress if we see it there. Katie, Lena, I was reading Joshua Rivera, who's writing in GQ about The Big Sick, and he was writing that. Let me just quote you here. He says, "The Big Sick," and this is a Latino guy who's known interracial relationships. And he says, "The Big Sick is the first time that I felt that a very subtle, very difficult aspect of my life was reflected on screen. A struggle that, given the success of the film as it goes into wide release this weekend, I suspect is shared by many. Sometimes there's a cost to interracial relationships. Sometimes there's no way of knowing whether culture will win out over parental support. There might not be a net to catch you." I mean, Lena, the gist of what Joshua is saying is that there's a new level of nuance here that he appreciates that comes closer to his actual lived experience in this country, in our culture.
Sure. Well, so one thing that I was thinking when I saw The Big Sick, you know, I think that we need to separate the argument of Kumail ending up with a white woman versus the portrayal of South Asian women in the film. They're not mutually exclusive, right? When I saw the movie, one of the things that I enjoyed the movie, I definitely saw aspects of my own relationship in there. It was at the expense of the South Asian woman, the betrayal at the South Asian woman. And
betrayal,
so
that's a strong word. Describe how you saw betrayal here.
No, not betrayal, portrayal.
Sorry. Oh, okay, portrayal. Okay, excuse me.
And so I think, you know, that's one of the things that I wanted to make sure that we separate. I think the argument is not that he ends up with a white woman, the interracial relationship. It's just the way. And so when you say nuanced, I had wished that the film was a little bit more nuanced in his relationship with his family. Because the relationship with Ray Romano and Emily's family really told a great story, which I thought was maybe lacking a little bit in his own end with that. So that was one of the things that I just definitely wanted to point out. And I'm glad that Sopan mentioned that this portrayal is just an example of many. And I think as we move on with future stories and hopefully we'll be able to see a variety of stories that speak to this. I mean, his experience was not my experience. My family has loved everybody that we've brought in, doesn't matter what race. And my sisters and I have dated all different types of people. And we've never had those kinds of experiences of being disowned or not being spoken to or any of that kind of stuff. So while I still related to it, I think part of it is just being able to see representation of any kind is exciting.
Let me get a little another piece of the puzzle in here. The Netflix series Master of None. I love this series. It's in its second season, a terrific season. It follows the romantic professional exploits of Dev Shah, played by Aziz Ansari. Here's a little bit from episode 4, following Dev on a series of first dates set up by the Love at First Sight app. And in this clip, we see an interaction between Dev and his date, Priya.
Can I ask you a question that you might find a little offensive?
I'm intrigued.
Do you just date Indian girls?
No, I date people of different ethnicities, skin tones. What about you? Is it Indian dudes only?
No, I'll date anyone.
Now I feel special.
Now I feel special. So, but she'll date anybody. It's America. And another little clip from Master of None, this time between Dev and his date Diana, a black woman. And they're talking about how dating apps make their matches and how race factors in.
Oh, being a black woman on these apps? Completely different situation. I mean, compared to my white friends, I get way less activity. I also find that I rarely match with guys outside of my race.
Same for me. A lot of my matches are Indian women. I did read somewhere that the people that do worst on the apps are Asian men and black women.
Well, it's great. White people finally have an advantage somewhere. Cheers to them.
To white people.
Okay, a little ironic humor there in Master of None. Katie Borum Chatu, join us here. What do you see? Evolution? Fast enough? Up to speed with what's happening in the culture? You and Lena have been out talking all over the country with people, or not?
Yeah. So thanks, Tom. It's great to be here. Well, a couple of different things. I mean, one of the things that I want to point out, first of all, is that when we talk about the kinds of stories that give this kind of authenticity and nuance, really what we're talking about is who has creative control over the storytelling. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's very important to acknowledge when we look at both Kumail's story and also Aziz Ansari. They both have creative control over that level of authenticity. That's very important. And I would say, just to throw it out here early, that's very different from sort of the sort of big Hollywood that's still a little uncomfortable about the idea that we might have people of different races. But
why,
you know,
uncomfortable? Because they don't think it does box office correctly, or they bring some kind of prejudice of their own to the undertaking?
I don't know if it's overt as prejudice of their own. I mean, look, there are a lot of conversations about diversity in Hollywood at the moment. It's not because it's a whole town of bad racist people. It's a whole systemic system. But one of the things that Lena and I have looked at in our film, so as you mentioned, we've been traveling around the country for about a year and a half, talking to all kinds of interracial couples, families, children of all different ages who are biracial and identify that way. And we asked the question, and we really look very closely at media portrayals, and we would agree with all of the guests on the show today and say, yes, it's certainly getting better from, you know, 1974 and the Jeffersons to today. But we really look at the quantity of the portrayal, the type of the portrayal, and why it matters. So one thing that I just like to bring into this conversation, mm-hmm. because it comes up organically in Lena and I's experiences with people all over the country all the time. When you look at portrayals of interracial families that appear on ads, for example, Old Navy, Cheerios, Sotheby's, there are a handful, I think Swiffer, and I only know Swiffer because our interracial family totally paid attention to that. Okay. We're like, we should buy a Swiffer. But those ads always come with a racist backlash. So,
when there's a mixed couple in a Cheerios ad or whatever
yes,
it may be.
Yes, it is a backlash. And so I think it's important to always acknowledge in this conversation that even while, yes, the storytelling is getting better, the portrayals are getting better, that's true, but we need to not ignore the deep legacy of discomfort in this country that comes from the legacy of slavery and other issues with race mixing that comes out in, you know, people absolutely freaking out to see an interracial family kind of just doing their thing on a Cheerios ad without sort of constant commentary about like, oh, I'm white and you're black and we must not be able to communicate in some way. But there, you know, there's usually a racist backlash, and we find it kind of amazing, actually, 50 years after interracial marriage was legalized in this country, that we actually still are in situations like that where there are headlines about The Bachelorette that say things like, is America ready for an interracial relationship? Like, it's 50 years after it was legal, which is both a lifetime ago and not at all far away. So I'll just sort of end my point here by saying that without question, when we talk with interracial families and couples and children all over the country, there's always conversations that deal with the humor that and sort of resilience inside an interracial family, where you have sort of funny race talk inside your own home as sort of a coping mechanism for the kind of sometimes steady stream of sort of racist paper cuts from people who don't necessarily see portrayals of you all the time. Interracial people don't, interracial families, I should say, we don't necessarily see ourselves reflected really fully on the entertainment marketplace yet. And this is not to be, you know, critical and just end it there, because again, it's getting better, but it's still not without constant commentary.
Plenty of racist paper cuts out there. Katie, stand by. A lot of callers for all three of you. Clover, Katie, Lena, Sarah's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I just wanted to share, I am a white woman, and I'm in Atlanta dating a wonderful Indian man, and we've been dating for 2 years. And since seeing some of these new pieces of media, especially like Meet the Patels on Netflix, that kind of documentary.
Yeah.
It was so validating to see some of the struggles with kind of families and acceptance, particularly from his family, with their expectations for dating, and to see reflected in a really comical way a lot of the same struggles. And it was like, oh, okay, I'm not alone.
It's helpful.
It's so helpful, yes. And very validating.
Yeah, it matters
really
to see.
Appreciated it.
It matters to see it up there, and I'm sure that's true. Meet the Patel back in 2015. Ravi Patel, his sister Gita, of course, and Ravi's trying to find a woman that both he and his parents can love. It matters if you see yourself, your relationships reflected in our popular culture. One more here, JB in Detroit. JB, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hey, how you doing now? Let me put it to you like this: there's two distinct issues that I see that happen.
Mm-hmm.
One is when you have interracial relationships, a lot of times you have that feeling for some people that, you know, especially if there's a white person involved, or are you trying to, you know, quote unquote, move up, or, you know, are you leaving your culture behind? So there's always that kind of uncomfortable stickiness.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing that I notice a lot that doesn't really get spoken on.
Mm-hmm.
And it bothers me a little bit, is that I think there's a huge problem in America. It's not all over the world, but in America, definitely. There's a fear of seeing black male sexuality. You don't have any black Brad Pitts. You know, you don't have any non-white George Clooney's. And so in particular, to see...
Are you so sure about that? I mean, I can think of some pretty hunky and attractive black... You know, I mean, Denzel Washington, or jumping anywhere you want.
Right. Exactly where you said, Tom, Denzel Washington. And everyone who's ever seen Pelican Brief knew what type of relationship.
Will Smith, I mean, is that not a black Brad Pitt? I don't know. Don't those count, JB? I'm not trying to. I guess you got a point, but aren't
they count, but to be honest, to be blunt, they're superficial. Because if it's okay for me and my white wife or co-star to be in love, but not for you to see the true passion that comes from people in love because you're scared to see a white woman swooning over a black man, that's still a problem.
Yes.
Clover, speak to JB's point out of Detroit.
Yeah, I do think there is that fear of black sexuality that stems from, you know, everything kind of stems from the days of slavery and kind of this fear of fetishization, but also like exoticizing. But then also as you're doing that, you're kind of like erasing the sexuality of this person who has, you know, like who has is a sexual being. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with seeing, you know, black sex. And I do think, like, in the shows that we have seen lately, you know, Insecure on HBO.
Yes.
There's Power on Stars. There's, you know, Being Mary Jane on BET. We are seeing more of the more black sexuality represented. And I think that's important. And there has been a history of not seeing that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Hollywood's depiction of interracial relationships these days, romance, and how it's changing from The Bachelorette with its first black bachelorette in this season. 13th season took a while to The Big Sick, Master of None, and more. Clover Hope is with us from Jezebel. She's been writes about pop culture there and is paying attention here. Katie Borum Chatu is with us from Washington. And Lena Jaiswal, they've been out talking with people across the country about mixed-race, interracial relationships. They're working on a documentary called Mixed, which will be headed your way at some point. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Are we past the Guess Who's Coming to Dinner shock and awe and getting down to nuances, getting real? Is everybody getting a fair shake in the new depictions of how we live and love? And what is Hollywood getting right now? What is it missing? We've been talking about The Big Sick, a man from a Pakistani-American family based on a real relationship. Last month, Emily Gordon, Real World Life of Kamil Nanjiani, who wrote The Big Sick with him, talked on The View about the movie and what people might take away from it.
I didn't meet anyone who was Muslim until I was in college. I was raised in a small town. And so what
Where
I get to
from?
See, North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. What I get to see, wonderfully enough, is Muslims hanging out and having fun. I get to see it all the time. And we really wanted other people to get to see that, too, because that's just part of what life is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not all sweetness and light, that's for sure. 2017 movie Get Out, Allison Williams plays Rose, a white woman whose family performs horrific acts against black people. But when her black boyfriend Chris, played by Daniel Kaluuya, starts dating her, he has no idea of all that horror. Here's a scene from early in the movie where Rose earns Chris's trust by standing up for him with a police officer.
Sir, can I see your license, please?
Wait, why?
Yeah, I have state ID.
No, he wasn't driving.
I didn't ask who was driving. I asked to see his ID.
Yeah, why? That doesn't make any sense.
Here.
No. That you don't have to give him your ID because you haven't done anything wrong.
Okay. It gets pretty scary from there. Lots of response online. Rachel says, let's not forget Bend It Like Beckham, female South Asian lead in love with a white UK man. Mimi Sun Goddess says, so glad interracial couples and children are being noticed. We are not taboo. We've always been here since before the existence of the United States. Couldn't be truer than that. Watt starts to take us into some of the complexities here. It says the interracial relationship I'm in is nothing like what you see on screen. It's better and worse. It's better because love found in us the worst parts. Dealing with the attacks of stupid from within is hard enough, but when you add stupid outside rooted in hate, can really take its toll. I mean, this isn't a rose garden. It's just as complicated as anything can be. Nicholas is calling from Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. Nicholas, you're on with Clover, Katie, and Lena.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I just wanted to comment on, I've been in an interracial relationship for the better part of the last 2 years. My girlfriend is white. We have a week-old interracial daughter. I'm Cuban black and white myself.
Okay.
unfortunately, you know, we have to, my girlfriend has just now become aware of the confused looks, the awkward stares that we get, where I've been made to feel like they're almost expected at this point, especially being in the Southeast. And, you know, it's just our job now to raise our daughter without those expectations and to be as accepting as possible. And I can understand the gentleman who was on earlier from New York, you know, expressing the view that Black American males are almost, they're not depicted in a way that you would understand that serious romantic or sexual, I guess, situation that they can be in. I mean, it's always a romantic comedy that's going to show the romantic side of an interracial relationship until you get something that's as developed as those serious dramas that are Academy Award winning. That's when you can start saying that, you know, we've really crossed the line and the acceptance of interracial relationships as a whole.
Nicholas, I really appreciate your call. I mean, Clover, this gets down to, you know, yes, we have a very multicultural, multiracial society, and lots of people are living and operating it across all kinds of lines. And yes, at the same time, Nicholas points out, he's got his own one-week-old child, and already he's feeling stares, he's feeling awkwardness. Both things are there, Clover.
Yeah, I think there's, and that's kind of part of the importance of representation and seeing a variety of, you know, portrayals of love, is that the average person, the average viewer who sees this, can kind of expand their idea of what a relationship looks like, or what their limited idea of what love should be, based on, which, you know, is probably based on their own life if they're from a small town or somewhere where they don't see a variety of people. And I think also the subtext of kind of the representation is that there's kind of this risk of erasure, which is the argument with the Big Sick. And I think
erasure,
Lena,
is this also JB's point from Detroit, the gentleman from Detroit who said, you know, we Black guys don't get fully represented. Nicholas kind of points to that as well. The full measure of passion and reality.
Right. There's a spectrum. And then also kind of I think Lena mentioned getting the nuance of the other side, like the issue with the Big Sick and, you know, like the other side of the arranged marriage, where the women that who look like Kumail were being kind of discarded in a way. And, you know, if you're not kind of, if this is the only representation, then people may look at that and kind of get this, the wrong idea. And
actually,
so I think that,
lastly,
I think that risk gets limited the more variety there is, basically.
Lena, sorry?
Oh, sorry. That was me. I'm going to take... This is Katie interrupting,
I
do. I'm so sorry, Clover. Actually, Tom, I wanted to make sure that Lena and I jumped in here because the reason we started making our movie is because of interracial children. And there's like a special kind of commentary that comes... So we think that that is a piece. When you asked what's missing when we talk about the new interracial portrayals, what's still missing is portrayals of biracial children who identify that way, biracial young people who identify with both parts of their identity, who really talk about it. Because we would say our experience, Lena and I's having children, that's where you hear the real comments that people want to make. And you kind of get a sense of where America is with all of this. So it's the exoticizing of your child, the, you know, in Lena's case, being asked if she's the nanny. I'm a white woman. Nobody's ever asked if I'm the nanny. But that's where we really see and understand that. And for children who are interracial, and acknowledging here that not every mix is the same, of course, Black, white, very different from Asian and white, from Asian and Black, et cetera. But biracial children, when we ask them this around the country, the product of these interracial romances, they definitely don't see themselves reflected, and they don't see themselves, importantly, reflected on the kinds of television programs and pop culture where they can really see themselves. And I'll just add here that my daughter, who's nine, who visibly looks, I think, biracial, whatever that means, she doesn't look white, she really is looking everywhere for representations of herself. She doesn't find it on television. She doesn't hear people having those conversations about, oh, I have a white mom and a Black dad, and here's what that means. So she goes to YouTube and finds all these amazing YouTube channels that really show biracial young people, teenagers, talking about themselves. And
Katie, we've got a call right on that point, if I may.
Sure.
Jason in Montgomery, Alabama. Jason, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, and that's a great point. It unfortunately came toward the end of the program, but that's my point. As a, I'm 35. I'm a biracial man, and that seems to be the thing that is missing in the conversation, to the extent that if you're in an interracial relationship, at any time you can, for whatever reason, decide that you don't want to be in it no more. But as a biracial person,
yeah,
I can never not be biracial. Like, that's who I am.
You are that.
So,
mm-hmm.
Right, I am that. So when we're in the discussion talking about the validity of those relationships or the integrity of those relationships, interracial relationships, you can't get around talking about the products of those relationships. And so to delegitimize the relationship is to delegitimize the product, which is, in this case, me.
Yeah. Growing up, you're 35, Jason. Did you see your family, your mixed-race parents, parents of different races depicted in the popular culture? Did you have anything to hang on to there?
Well, so my story is a little bit more complicated than that. I was adopted when I was 3
okay.
by a black couple who are wonderful. And I never knew my birth parents, except I met my birth mother later in life.
Got it.
I still am not sure who my father is, but, biological father, my
yes,
father, of course.
Certainly.
First, the man that raised me.
Understood.
But my thing growing up was I grew up in a time where race was really, it was only two choices. You're either black or white.
Yeah.
And maybe Indian or Eskimo. And so I was tickled when I began to see mark all that apply. That was like the most wonderful thing to me, because maybe I was the only one that got a kick out of it, but then I could actually check two boxes. And so that was that was amazing to me.
Yeah.
So
out of the box at last.
Right, exactly. And so now being older, I mean, I'm secure in who I am, so there's no problem. But when you have that discussion, you can't minimize the relationship and then look biracial kids in the face and say, well, you're important too. And it's like, no, you just said that my parents should have never had me, basically. So
yes.
I think that part needs to be, as your guest mentioned, that needs to be a part of the
right in the middle of this, Jason, and you put it there, so does Katie, and I'm glad for that. I mean, this gets lived, and then it gets lived again if there are kids involved. Lena, what are you thinking as you listen here?
Yeah, so one of the things that we've really discovered on this journey was that not only is it important for biracial children or people to see themselves represented, it's important for others to see biracial people on screen or represented, because that helps, and I hate this word, but helps to normalize that experience. So speaking to Jason's call, you know, there is another film that we haven't actually touched on called Little Boxes, and it stars Nelson Ellis, and it's an interracial family, a white woman, black father moving from Brooklyn with their son who's teenaged to a small town in Washington. And there is a film that I think if your viewers haven't seen, I would definitely recommend, where you get to see those nuances of the everyday experience of being a parent of a biracial child, and how sometimes you get excluded in some parenting decisions and how you get included. And so I just would recommend that film as a good stepping point to seeing families represented. But again, to hit the nail on the head about seeing representation of biracial people, it helps everybody, not just the people, the biracial kids themselves.
Let's go to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Gabrielle. Gabrielle, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi there, Tom. This is a question for the panel, the movie and the mixed kids. Did they ever see a hierarchy of kids of dating? So, for example, white women are at the top and black women are at the bottom. I know I can take my answer off of the air.
Is there a hierarchy? Clover, let me bring that first to you. Do you see a kind of a gradated hierarchy of who dates whom, where, what, how? I mean, we heard Aziz Ansari talking about that in the little clip we played from Master of None, where he and the black woman he's on a date with, I think Aziz says, you know, Asian guys like me and black women, at least on apps, sort of taking the toughest road here. What about a hierarchy?
Yeah, I think visually when we... there is a hierarchy visually in the film, in film and TV, as far as what gets represented first. And I'm not sure what that's based on, but definitely in my experience on dating apps, there's I related to that scene when I was watching it in Master of None of kind of, you know, and there have been statistics about dating apps that kind that show breadth of popularity on these apps where, you know, if you're a white man, white woman on these apps, there are a lot more options. And if you are a black woman, you know, you're probably not going to get that many white, Asian, et cetera.
What about The Bachelorette this season? You say you've watched it now that Rachel Lindsay is there. Very lovely, young black woman, but the first black woman ever to be The Bachelorette. And, of course, the guys, I mean, there was that huge pool at the beginning, I guess, of all kinds of racial and cultural representation. It's come down, I think, now to a white guy, a black guy, and a Latino sort of fair-skinned guy. You know, I know it's 2017, so you might say it's just high time. On the other hand, there was a time when this is just unimaginable. It's years ago now, I suppose. But what do you make of what's being depicted there, Clover?
Yeah, the Bachelorette is an interesting case because Rachel has talked about the pressure that she feels as a black woman, as the first black bachelorette, and kind of having to be, quote unquote, twice as good. You know, she's a lawyer. She's, you know, she's really smart and funny.
Yes.
Whereas some of the previous, you know, contestants or some of the previous bachelors and bachelorettes, they are not like the pickings, like the top pickings.
But her choice is going to be dissected in racial terms, and you know that, and we know that, and she knows that as she's sitting there.
Right. There's a lot of pressure on who she picks, and, you know, that comes with the territory of you know, like being on the show. And I wish the show was a little bit more nuanced in kind of showing the discussions between her and the other guys. I think they played up the interaction between one of the black contestants and one of the white ones to kind of like play up the racial angle, because the white guy, Lee, was, you know, revealed to have like some racist tendencies. So, you know, they kind of went more for that than actually having discussions about like the one that you the audio that you aired earlier was kind of rare on the show, where they actually talked about, okay, this is who I've dated before and what it means. And I think it's important to kind of see that on a real, or what's supposed to be a real show.
Yeah, it's always some kind of reality. Lena, how close are we to a depiction of what's really out there that you and Katie are finding? Are we,
well,
are we,
you know,
10% to 50%, 80%? I don't know.
I don't know if we could put a percentage to that, but one thing that I would bring up is the idea of colorism in terms of the hierarchy, the question about the hierarchy. You know, we often hear, both Katie and I and a lot of our friends who have mixed race babies, often the kids are fetishized because of their color. Oh, they're just the right color mocha. Yes. They're like in between these two things. And so we do want to keep the idea of colorism in mind.
Right. They're evaluated.
Yeah. I used to live in India. Of course, South Asia has its own rich history and present of colorism. Every possible shade you can find in the marriage ads
queens.
There. Right.
Yeah.
All that. And now here we are in this country with all of our complexity and maybe a little more nuanced depiction going on these days. We're grateful to all three of you for helping us look at it. Katie Boram-Chatu, it's great to have you with us from American University. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Lena Jaiswal, our great thanks to you there at AU as well. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
We'll look for your film Mixed. And Clover Hope at Jezebel, thank you so much for joining us today, Clover.
Thank you so much.
Good luck to all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Hi, I'm Ron Suskind.
And I'm Heather Cox Richardson.
We're the hosts of Freak Out and Carry On, a new politics and history podcast from WBUR.
Hey, thanks for sticking around for this preview from our show. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe to Freak Out and Carry On wherever you get your podcasts.
Take a listen to this excerpt. We chatted about Trump's approval ratings and historical parallels. And I guess my question is, when was the last time you had a president arrive into office and summon this sort of vigorous public protest?
Well, it was the presidency that everybody comes to first whenever they think about American history, and that was the presidency of Benjamin Harrison.
Oh, of course. I mean, the stage play, I love that, and the musical they did. It's fabulous, yeah.
Everyone always forgets about Benjamin Harrison, and there's a reason for that. He gets written out of history, but it was a very similar situation. A person who came to office after a Democratic president, Cleveland, who was popular among people who wanted reform, wanted to make sure the government government did not work just for the very wealthy. Harrison said that he would make some reforms, including to the tariff, did not win the popular vote, lost the popular vote by 100,000 votes. Gets put in with the Electoral College. As soon as he gets in, it's very clear that there's been hanky-panky going on. People are infuriated by that. They start to protest, and Harrison and his men keep saying, no, 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 we've got this. We know how to make America work again, how to bring the economy back, although it wasn't actually that bad right then. He puts his son into an important position and simply refuses to note that there is these protests going on, that people are literally starving out in the West. And he completely misses what's happening out West, which is, again, this huge protest that becomes the Alliance Movement of 1890, which takes over the House of Representatives by a margin of 2-1 that year and virtually flips the Senate. And Harrison is completely blindsided by it.
Right, and drives politics forward from that point. I mean, in a way, the reaction to Harrison becomes the defining thing of that
period. That's exactly right, and that's where we get the populist movement. And again, the progressive movement grows out of that at the turn of the next century.